Today on Catfish Best Source, we got a real treat for you folks. We have a guy whose name just goes with catfishing in the United States. I would hope anyone who's catfish knows this man. We bring in and visit with you Keith Catfish Sutton, author, catfisherman, famous catfish personality from the Grand Forks Best Source Studio. Welcome to Catfish Best Source. I'm your host, Brad Durek, joined by producer Paul, who always takes care of us and makes sure this works. I'm going to get started early this week with my tip of the week. My tip of the week for everybody this week is just pay attention to your surroundings. Watch what the trees are doing. Watch what the deer are doing. A lot of things can be taught by just watching what's going on around you. If there's cottonwoods dropping cotton, chances are you're getting into the spawn. Like we mentioned in a previous show, if the lilacs are blooming, chances are you're getting ready for the pre-spawn, and fishing should be pretty good. As far as products this week, I always like to talk about one little product. There's one that I'm going to bring up that everybody should have five of, in my opinion, which is a simple pliers. I think everyone should have at least three or four in a boat. If you're a shore angler, you should have at least two of them in your bag, because it seems like you never have one when you need one. I always have three in the boat. Just thought I'd bring that up for a simple little product tip. But let's get down to business. As I mentioned before, we have author Keith Sutton with us. He's written five books. Five, right, Keith?
That's right.
Including Fishing for Catfish, Pro Tactics, Catfish Beyond the Basics. I have that one with me.
All right.
And the last one, Hardcore Catfishing. I have that one with me as well. Keith, welcome aboard.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, Brad. We get a chance to talk now and then, but I haven't had a chance to visit with you on your show, so this will be fun.
Well, this is a pretty pretty new show. I mean, you're only one of the first episodes, so we're bringing in whoever we have around the country, and we want to make it interesting for everybody. And I can't think of many people quite as interesting as you. I've read these books. You've been all around the world catfishing. Tell us some of the places you've been and some of the catfish you've caught.
Well, there's a lot of places I still need to go yet, that's for sure. There's probably more of those than places I've been. But on the north, the furthest I've been is the Red River in Canada. We were just talking about that a little. That was probably one of the most epic catfish trips I ever made. I just mentioned, I think every channel cat I caught on a trip up there was bigger than any I'd ever caught during 40 years of fishing for that species. So that was a cool place to go. I think I've catfished now in about 30 states in the U.S. And then I've also done a lot of catfishing south of the border. I've fished in several lakes in Mexico. You don't hear a lot about Mexico, but it's actually got a lot of really great catfishing, because nobody down there hardly fishes for catfish. There's some really good trophy lakes down there. And I spent several years kind of exploring some of those. And then I've also fished in Brazil in several locations. And I have fished one time in Venezuela as well on a lake called Lake Guri. Those South American trips are pretty unbelievable. They have a wide variety of huge catfish down there. My biggest catfish I ever caught was down there. It was 100-pounder, and the locals called it a fry. It was just a baby, they said. That tells you how big they get sometimes down there, sometimes over 600 pounds. And I spent about, I guess it was 6 or 7 years in a row I went down hoping to catch a new world record while I was there. I never accomplished that, but during that time I caught a lot of new species that I'd never had an opportunity to fish for. And I actually caught one species on the Xingu River in Brazil that turned out to be a species that had never been described by science. So that was pretty cool. So I fished all the way from Canada to Brazil and Venezuela and points in between, but there's still a lot more I'd like to do.
So before we go any further, that one that hadn't been discovered before, did you Number one, how did you know, and what did you do with the fish so it could be discovered?
Yeah, well, when I would go on my trips, I didn't know what types of fish a lot of times I was catching. And in the case of Brazil, I found a gentleman at Cambridge University in Massachusetts who had spent a lot of time studying the fish of the Amazon basin. He knew just about everything that was down there. So he and I had an agreement. I would send him photos of every fish that I caught and could photograph, and he would tell me the scientific name of those fish so I could identify them correctly in my files. And I sent him a picture of that particular fish, which was a species of armored catfish. It was a very unusual fish. It was known by the locals. They catch a lot of them, but they call it a quiu-quiu. It was a crazy-looking thing with spikes and spines all over it. Made a real crazy noise. Weighed up to about 5 pounds. And when this gentleman, Andrew Camoes with the university, saw it, he got back in touch with me and said, "Hey, buddy, you found one here. I can't identify it. It's never been identified." And to the best of my knowledge, it still hasn't been named. That's a very long, time-consuming process to give a new creature a name, but Mr. Camoes is working on that. So I'm hoping someday maybe that'll be Keith Catfish Sutton's catfish. I don't know.
About what year did that one come around? Is that fairly recent, or is that an older one?
No, that was in 2006, I believe was the year. So it's been a while.
You're not joking. They don't hurry up on stuff like that, huh?
No. In fact, it's kind of a interesting thing that many people don't know. Catfish are the most numerous group of fish on Earth. They comprise 10% of all vertebrate animals on Earth. And there have been almost 2,000 new species identified in the past 10 years. And every day they're finding new species, particularly in South America.
And we primarily chase three.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the cool things about going down there. We've got three cats that get big. And down there they've got more in the neighborhood of 100 that get, 50 pounds or bigger. Some incredible fish down there.
So I noticed in your listing the places you had fished, Europe and the Mekong weren't on that list. I'm guessing those are still on the list and waiting?
Yeah, one of the top things I'd like to do is go to Europe and fish for Wells catfish. I've met a lot of people who do that, and someday I think that opportunity will become available to me. I'd really like to go to Spain. I've kind of identified that as the key spot I'd like to go and try for those big Wells catfish. There's a lot of really big fish in 100 to 200 pound range being caught on some of the rivers there in Spain, and some even bigger. There's a lot of fish in Asia, and perhaps my first opportunity to try for Asian catfish might come along sooner than others. I have a son who's living right now in Bangkok, Thailand, and they have some really big catfish in Thailand, and I'd certainly like to try for them and may have that opportunity if I get to visit him.
That's where those Mekongs are, isn't it, Thailand?
Yeah, they're partly in Thailand, and that's a possibility. I know they do have some lakes around Bangkok that are actually stocked with Mekong catfish. I don't know how well they do, but I know people do catch them. It's different than catching wild fish, as you'd imagine. But still, it'd be awesome to catch one of those fish.
So I kind of got ahead of myself with that whole travel question, but
we could talk all day just about that.
It's interesting that you've been all those places. So let's go way back to What got you started in catfishing? Were you a kid? Is it just what you did because it was by your house? Or kind of where was the beginnings at for you?
I grew up in a small town in eastern Arkansas, about 50 miles west of Memphis, Tennessee. I grew up in the Delta, and I had several great uncles who had farms, and they had stock ponds on their farms. And one of those uncles actually built a big pond, stocked it with good-sized catfish, and put it off limits to everybody except the kids in the family. And that's where I really got the bug. That was my Uncle Pat. And Pat really had a thing for bringing in big cats and throwing them in the pond so we could catch them. So even when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I was fishing Uncle Pat's pond, and I was always chasing those big fish he'd put in there. Sometimes it'd be a 20 or 30 pound fish, you know, and so that was kind of like trying to grab the golden ring from the carousel for us kids, trying to catch those big cats. But we fished a lot on ponds around where I grew. There were probably 50 or more ponds within a bicycle ride of my home when I was a kid. But we also, I lived in a part of the state where we had big rivers, too. There were three big rivers, the Mississippi, the St. Francis, and another river called the Langie that I could bike to if I wanted. And occasionally, when I got a little bit older in my teens, my uncles would take me fishing on those rivers. So that's where I really started learning about catching big catfish, good trophy-sized fish. And I really, I always loved catfish. I just like fishing, to be honest with you. Everybody calls me Catfish, but you could call me Mr. Brim or Mr. Walleye or whatever. I just like to catch fish. But catfish are kind of unique in so many ways that they're fun to study. They're fun to learn about. I don't think I'll ever learn everything there is to learn. I mean, every time I visit with a fellow angler, I learned something new. There's so many facets to the sport. And when I started writing back in the early 1980s, I decided, well, I need a niche that I can call my own. And there was nobody hardly writing about catfish then. And I decided that would be my niche. I put a catfish on my stationery and letterhead and started trying to sell editors on buying catfish stories. And back in those days, it was hard to do. You couldn't find anybody hardly would publish a story about catfish. They were just looked down upon by most people as trash fish. Of course, you and I both know that's not the case anymore. But back then, it really was. You could go fishing almost anywhere in the country and catch as many as you wanted, and there were no limits. There was no limit on what kind of tackle you used. Back then, I saw sometimes trot lines that were over a mile long. Just people just really depleting the catfish resource. So it was good for me. It came along at a good time. People were wanting to catch more big fish. Once I started selling a few of those stories and getting feedback, people wanted more, and editors started to listen, you know, and started publishing more about catfish. And so I decided, well, this is a great opportunity to help teach people how to catch catfish and what they're all about. And so I've spent the last, gosh, it's been 40 years now, writing about catfish in a lot of ways, and that's how those books came along.
Well, you, the very first time we spoke on the phone, which is now pushing a decade already since I was working on my first book, and you said that, you said, you know, you're doing this right. You said you got to find yourself a niche and you got to run with it once you get it. And, you know, it seems to be kind of the road I've gone down as well, is, you know, own it. So,
yeah,
obviously, you've done this for quite some time, and you say it was difficult. to sell one, and now it's still difficult to sell one because everybody's willing to write them for free now. But
yeah, exactly.
Anyways,
it's a different world.
Obviously, you've seen a lot of changes, and one that you brought up was it was pretty much the Wild Wild West and anything goes, and now that it's popular and people want big fish, you know, we're seeing it now. People are trying to get into some regulations and some protections and make them game fish, and we're very lucky up here that we have very staunch regulations for them. What are you seeing down in your part of the country? I read about it on social media, but is there any gains in the conservation of the trophy catfish being made down there?
Yeah, I think there are. It's slow. It's very slow progress, and sometimes it's frustrating. It takes so long, but more and more we're seeing limits restricted. We're seeing tackle restricted. We're primarily seeing things like slot limits and length limits that help certain fisheries. More I see stuff happening not down here in the south or southeast. I see more of it happening really up in your neck of the woods. A good example would be a man I'm sure you know, Ted Ellenbecker's been working really hard up in the Dakotas to try to get some length limits passed on flatheads, and I believe that's come to bear fruit, and y'all will start seeing up in that neck of the woods some gains tremendously in the amount of fish people can catch and the size. It's still hard in areas. There's still a lot of places in the country that you just can't get rid of that stigma of catfish being some kind of a bottom feeding disreputable fish. That's not true, we know, but still a lot of people look at catfish that way in certain areas. But I think we're seeing some progress. We need to see some more. It takes people to make that happen, and we don't have enough of folks like Ted who are willing to sacrifice the time it takes to visit those state wildlife and fisheries agencies and go to those meetings and visit with those biologists, try to make all that happen. It's not easy.
Yeah, Ted's actually gotten to be a real good friend of mine in the past few years. And
oh, he's a great guy. We've been friends a long time.
I know he's got South Dakota wrapped up, and he's got either Iowa or Nebraska wrapped up and the other one coming. I can't remember which combination that is, but it's on the flatheads, and it should really, like you said, pay some dividends down the way. You know, we've had real good regs up here. I mean, our limit for our channel cats is 5, with only one can be over 24 inches. You get up to the Canadian side, it's 0. And we're learning more and more and more about these fish to that we have to protect those big fish. And University of Nebraska, I'm sure you've read their studies up here. They've been running tag studies and netting studies and all kinds of length studies since 2012, and I actually got Mark Pegg from University of Nebraska slated to come on here and talk about all that on a future show, but they're telling us a lot. They're telling us that our fish grow a lot slower than we initially thought. Their answers have brought up a lot more questions, and one of them being, are these fish growing so slow that are they actually much, much older than we've once thought they were? That's one of the things we're going to talk about in depth when he's on with me. But, you know, that if that's true, that puts even more pressure on selective harvest and conservation of the big fish, because, you know, I always say you can't get a 20-year-old fish every day if you keep them, but what if they're 30 or even 40 years old? That just ups the ante all the way.
We used to think a lot of these big fish down here were old fish, but the more we learned about them through scientific studies, the more we found out they weren't as old as we thought down here. For instance, in this neck of the woods, there's no fish that grows faster than a flathead catfish, nothing. They'll put on 10 pounds a year sometimes down here. And we used to think those fish might be 30, 40 years old, and it turns out they're probably not, most of them. But your point is that this scientific research is important. And I'm a biologist by training myself. I've got a degree in wildlife management and studied fisheries. And it's extremely important, I think, that we support our universities and state fish and wildlife agencies in the research that they're trying to do, because we learned so much from that we didn't know. There's been a lot of studies done on catfish, but there sure needs to be a lot more. There's so much we could learn. I really enjoy, you mentioned University of Nebraska, I believe, and they have come out with some really key studies where they've been tracking fish movements that always interested me. I learn a great deal about where those fish are at certain times of year by reading those scientific papers to find out what they learned. And it sometimes will boggle your mind. Oh, that's where they are. That's why I wasn't finding them on that trip. Or that's why that trip was so good, because we learn they do particular things at particular times of the year. And if we know what those things are, that can improve our fishing a great deal.
Well, you bring that up. I ended up kind of accidentally getting involved in that study, and I'll just give it the short version of it. The local outdoor writer is one of my best friends, and of course he was doing stories about that this was going to be happening, and we were sitting there visiting one day, and I said, man, you know they're going to get down here from Canada. Wouldn't it be neat if someone actually caught one? Well, we had a summer flood, and somebody caught one. And then a couple days, I said, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we could catch one? Well, I ended up catching two in the same day.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, catfish, when there's certain times a year where they like to move upstream, and certain water conditions, right, of high water where they like to move upstream, and the Red River running north is actually, we're upstream of it. So we knew these Canadian fish would move in here. It's just we didn't have any proof. So we had the right spring flood with the right temperature combination, and all of a sudden I'm catching these things like crazy, and the grad student at the time called me up, and he said, why are you catching all these fish? I said, well, number one, I'm out every day, and number two, the stars aligned. We got the right water temperature, the right flow, the dams are flooded, and they're making their upstream migration. He goes, well, tell me about this upstream migration. I said, well, they just do it. You know, when the water's high, the temperature's right, you know, summer flood, post-spawn, whatever. And he goes, well, why are we doing the study? I said, well, I don't know. Guess prove me right. Whatever. So I ended up getting to be real good friends with all of them, both grad students in charge and Mark from the main man down at University of Nebraska, and caught a lot of tagged fish. And, you know, we put a lot of data together. And, like they said, it was just kind of fortunate to have one guy that was out all the time to kind of keep an eye on catching them. But I managed to catch the same tagged fish twice, which, wow, what's the chances of that?
Yeah, no kidding.
And I got to spend a day on the Canadian side with Mark putting tags in. And at the end of our afternoon together, I snapped a picture of the sheet, and I said, just in case I should run into one of these 14 tags I put in. Wouldn't you know it, 2 years later, we got one.
Wow. No.
So that's my holy grail. That fish traveled, well, from where I tagged it to where we caught it was about 270 miles of river.
Wow.
But what's the chances of tagging 14 fish and getting one 270 miles
later? Right, that's amazing.
So that's my holy grail, but that's what we learned from that, and that's more of the things we can learn if these keep going on. And I know they're doing flatheads down in Nebraska, or they just finished it up, or they're just doing it too. I'll get more when I interview them for the show.
Yeah, I'm eager to learn more about flathead movements. Apparently, from what little we know now, we don't think they move a lot compared to blue and channel catfish. But I think there's a lot to learn there, too. I know going to South America made me think about a lot of things in regard to fish movements. My first trip down there, I was there at a time of year that the locals call Paracema. And Paracema, many of the catfish in Brazil, they're among the longest migrating fish in the world. Some of them migrate from the estuaries of the Amazon to the headwaters and back every year. That's several thousand miles. And there's no dams to block their movement. So at villages all along the river, there's a certain time of year, twice a year, they know these massive migrations of fish are going to pass their villages. It might be in one village that it happens in early March every year, and then the next village downstream, it's in late March, and the next village early April, and it progresses because it's just schools of fish migrating. That made me start thinking, did our fish here make those long migrations before we had dams? Did they migrate from up in Minnesota down to New Orleans? I think maybe they did, in particular blue cats. Blue cats have long migrations. And so it's always fun to read the results of these studies and find out what the truth is. You know, do they do that? Do they not? How have they adapted? And how can I find them if I want to catch them? So, you know, learning how to read those scientific studies, that's a good way for anglers to get a head up on their buddies. If you read those studies and see what they're finding out, that can really help your fishing a lot. I try in all of my books to include a lot of scientific research that people may not know about, because a lot of times it's so eye-opening for us as anglers.
Well, not being a scientist myself at all, I will tell you those scientific papers are hard to read. So you just, I kind of skim through them and get what I can understand and read some of the graphs. And I've been very fortunate with these Nebraska studies that if there's something I question, I can just call the person who wrote up the thing and ask them. But not everybody gets that luxury to make that phone call or send that email and get that answer.
A lot of times, you know, I worked here for 20 years at the Game and Fish Commission, and our fisheries biologists here were very receptive to people talking to them and asking questions and gaining knowledge that they didn't have. And I'm sure it's that way in a lot of places. You might not always be able to connect with somebody, but I think most of the time you can if you make the effort. So if you find something that interests you and you can find out how to reach those people, that can be helpful.
So, you know, you said something now quite a while ago about this, and I wanted to back up. You said it's your fish down there tend to be younger than you guys thought, and we're kind of wondering if our fish up here are older than we thought.
Right.
And back when I was writing the first book, I was doing a lot of study into metabolisms and how they act based on their metabolic needs, and it's all water temperature based. And I came up with the theory, and I have nothing scientific to base this on at all, other than when I was putting pen to paper. One of the reasons that your fish might be younger, and in the case of channel cats, may not grow as big, besides flatheads and blue cats eating them and anglers fishing for them more down there, is I wonder if a fish doesn't have a metabolic lifespan. And because it's warmer, they're actually burning theirs up quicker. Yes, they grow faster, but they actually burn their metabolic life up quicker than they do here, where they spend 5 months of the year under the ice.
Yeah, I think that's a good theory. I've heard it espoused before. I interviewed some biologist in Canada who had done work on the Red River, and we were comparing notes just sort of like you and I are now, and that was what one of their biologists thought. He said the cold water seems to extend that metabolic life, if that's what you want to call it, and those fish live much, much longer. I know some of the fish that I caught while I was up there were, I want to say at least one of them was over 20 years old. We had some of those fish. They collected the otoliths from some of those fish to age. They were much older than I expected. But it made sense them being so much further north than I am here. But I think maybe that's right. But again, there's something else we need to learn more about to figure out. But I have no doubt you may not consider yourself a trained biologist, but you know a lot of biology. I know that from reading your writing and your books. And a lot of times that's where it starts, is somebody like you who's spending time out there and observing things every day that the rest of us don't notice. I think that's an important part of the learning process for all of us. You can learn a heck of a lot from a guide who spends every day on the water when most of us get to go a few weekends a year.
Well, that's, you know, I'll give you that one. That, you know, there's things you pick up on when you're there every day. You don't have to repattern them. You
definitely
gotta just kind of jump right back in where you left off, and that is one of the luxuries of being out there every day, is you just kind of start where you left off. But you learn some little tricks in there too. You know, spot, you can't go to your same spot every day, you'll kill it. So you got to learn how to rotate, and you got to learn all that fun stuff. But that's another story for another day, is spot rotation. So, but you know, we've mentioned right at the beginning that you've been around for a while. I kind of want to change gears from the biology part, although I could spend the next hour and a half talking about just that. Going back to the 80s up to now, obviously I've seen a huge boom, and I've been around a lot less time as far as the commercial side of it and the popularity of it with TV and writings and product, you know, boats specifically. Right. I mean, are you surprised by that? Is that, you know, what have you kind of observed in that career? I mean, as it went from the beginning,
I'm really
to
not
now.
Surprised about it. A lot of us work toward that goal, you know, trying to make that happen. People ask me all the time, why is catfishing so much popular now than it used to be? It's not, as far as I can tell. If you look at all the surveys that have been done, catfishing in years past was probably even more popular than it is now. But we hear more about catfishing now. There's more magazine stories. There's more books. There's more websites and podcasts and what have you. So we hear about it a lot more. And I think that is what started us on this road to where catfishing became visibly popular. There's probably some areas it's more popular in than it used to be, but I could show you just tons of research I've done digging up old information. And I'll give you a good example. Lewis and Clark, I just read their journals. It's full of references to catching catfish on their journey up the Missouri River. It's very interesting for anybody interested in catfishing. They caught a lot of fish over 100 pounds, and there were days they caught more than 400 catfish to feed the crews on their boats. So it's not anything new, but it's much more visible. It's people are seeing it more, and people are asking more and more questions. They see it now, and they go, excuse me, I want to catch one of those 50-pounders. You know, a lot of people enjoy bass fishing, but there's a lot of those folks would like to catch a 50-pound fish, and they're not going to do it while they're bass fishing.
I actually had that point that you made about more visible and maybe not as, you know, the same popularity or so. I actually had that on my sheet to ask you about, because the very first time I interviewed you back in 2012, that was one of the questions I asked you specifically, was the growing popularity, and what you just said is exactly right. What you said to me then, and it's boomed since then again.
Yeah, it has. We're now seeing one of the big things that's happened in recent years. It's slowed down a little bit this year, and that may have a lot to do with the pandemic, is product. There were so many years you could not buy a rod made specifically for catfishing, or a reel, or accessories that you might use, or terminal tackle hooks and swivels and weights. Now there's tons of stuff you can get. There's probably still some things some of us would like to see out there that's not as common as we'd like, but it hasn't been that long ago none of that was available. Every year I write stories for magazines about all the new products that are available. And this year I'm not seeing a lot. There's not a lot that's new out this year, but this is an exceptional year, and I think that's part of the reason. But I just wrote a story and talked about 20 new catfish rods that are out. And that's unbelievable to some of us who remember times where there wasn't any such thing as a catfish rod. They had that specific name on it that was made really for a catfish angler. They might put a catfish name on something that was used for muskies or saltwater or something, but it wasn't a real catfish rod. Now we're seeing companies paying attention to how many anglers are out there and how many of them want something. And I'll give you a really good example when I first saw it. When I tried to sell my first catfishing book, which is called Fishing for Catfish, I went to several publishers, had the book written. I knew it was a good book. I knew it would sell well because there wasn't anything else out there, hardly. There was one In Fisherman book out there, but it was really technical and scientific, and I thought folks out there wanted something simpler. But I couldn't sell the book. And the reason I couldn't, all of those publishers said catfish anglers aren't going to buy a book. And I said, why do you think that? Why would you imagine that somebody, just because they fish for catfish, won't buy a book? And every one of them, without exception, said, I see catfish anglers sitting on buckets on the side of the road, and I know they're not spending money or they wouldn't be doing that. And I'm like, yeah, but you're not paying attention, because there's doctors and lawyers and construction people and all kind of folks from all walks of life that are fishing for catfish. You're just paying attention to the ones you think are catfishermen. So I finally found a publisher, and he said, I agree with you. I think a catfish book will sell well. And I told him, I said, I want this book to be full color. I want it to be a hardback. I want it to be really nice. I want it to have good photographs in it. I want it to have solid scientific information in it people can understand. And he agreed with me, and he published that first book in that way. The first year, we sold 30,000 copies. The next year, he did a second print run and sold 10,000 more. And for 5 years, it was the number one selling outdoor book on Amazon. Folks bought the heck out of it, and he and I could gloat a little bit, because we knew catfish anglers aren't just folks that sit on buckets on the side of the road. They're every man. You know, there's people from all walks of life enjoy catfishing. Men, women, young, old, all sorts of careers. You can't label catfish people in one way. And I think a lot of manufacturers now are finding that's true with rods, reels, terminal tackle line, all of those things, that there's a market for it if you provide a good quality product specifically geared to using for catfish. And that last part's important. It can't just be a hook. It has to be something, you know, special, you know, for catfish. We're seeing more and more and more stuff available now. And that also makes catfishing as a whole more visible, too, I think. Because when other anglers go to Bass Pro Shop or the local tackle shop, they see those products and they know there's folks out there using them.
You know, to that point, one of the things I've noticed in just looking around is you're seeing the online boom of that stuff, and you're seeing the smaller bait shops and more of the niche marketplaces, but the big box stores still aren't quite caught up with a lot of that stuff.
Yep.
When you go around, they're expanding a little bit. They're giving it another foot or two of, you know, so now instead of 4 feet, it's 5. But, you know, it's still not caught up to what the niche marketplaces are going to do, and online in particular.
Yeah, I was just recently working on an online story, actually for a publication in Great Britain, believe it or not. They were wanting to publish some facts about catfishing in the U.S., and I was looking at they wanted some product information. I was looking at all the products that came out last year, and I was really surprised when I started looking online to see which of those were available still, because I needed to be sure they could find them online. There was quite a few of them that just came out last year, and they're not available anymore. They've already left the product lines for those companies. It's largely because they're not selling well. You don't remove a product you've spent years researching and putting together unless it doesn't sell. So perhaps, too, we're not doing as good a job as anglers of buying those products. And I think sometimes we could do a better job supporting those companies that support us, too.
One of the things that has come up is I've started working with one of the big companies over the last couple of years, and we were going through some of their catfish lines, and it's like, well, what's this? You know, why is it made like this? Well, that's what catfishermen want. Well, that's not what I want. Well, it was some guy, we need a catfish product, we'll make him a catfish product. But they didn't make it right. And then there was another one where they hit the nail on the head but put a stupid name on it and didn't tell anybody what it was for. It was, in this case, it was specifically, not that I'm a bumping expert by any means, but it would have been the most amazing bumping rod ever, I think. But it was listed as a general-purpose catfish rod with a really big price tag and completely marketed wrong. And that's why the regional rep wanted me to come in was, you know, at least we can get a pair of eyes on this before we spend a bunch of money producing it.
Right.
And I said, guy, you got this one. It's perfect. You're not selling it to the right people. And this one's good. You're not selling it to the right people. The description's wrong. If I read that description on your website, I would blow right past it, not knowing what it is. So that's what we're kind of working on in that front, is just bringing it more to make sense, so to speak.
We're starting to see a few companies. I'll give you one good example, a company that I've always liked their products. I'm not getting paid to make an advertisement, but B&M Poles, you mentioned bumping rods. They're marketing some bumping rods, and they were developed by anglers that really bump. I've been out with some of them. And, in fact, I remember it hadn't been that many years ago. Who ever heard of bumping? What the heck is that? And I get in a boat with Bill Dance, and we bumped. I said, I've never heard of bumping. Where'd this come from? And he said, that's what all the anglers are doing here in Memphis on the Mississippi River. I said, this is awesome. I mean, we caught some really big fish with that tactic. And then it wasn't long before B&M came out with a bumping rod. And I think it's a good one. I use it that way. So a few companies are paying attention and I think doing a good job marketing, but even B&M, they've only put out just a few products so far. They could do so much more. They've always had a niche with crappie anglers. They're known as a crappie company, but they're trying to cross over into the catfish market too. And I think not just B&M, there's companies like Berkeley Fishing and some others that have put the effort in there and do market some good products. But occasionally they throw something out there that's like, what made y'all think we wanted this? This doesn't work. And there's a lot of companies that do that. Being one of those guys that's visible because of my writing, talking about catfish, I get calls all the time from companies. Would you sit down and tell us, we're going to make a new boat. What do we need to do to make a catfishing boat? That's an actual scenario that happened to me. And I said, I'd be glad to if I get the first one when it rolls off the line. That's what it costs you. But even then, they wouldn't listen. I said, if you really want a catfish boat, here's what it's got to have. It's got to have a huge live well. It's got, you know, it needs to be quiet when I step on the bottom. Things like that. You need to make it where it doesn't make a bunch of racket. And I could go on and on, but nobody ever listened. They wanted to know, but then when I would tell them, they wouldn't listen. And they'd come out with products or boats in that case that were marketed to catfishermen, but they didn't listen to what catfishermen really want. And none of those products are available now. They came out and they wouldn't sell, and now they're gone. Those folks have got to learn to listen. Really, in my mind, and I tell you what, I spent a lot of time trying to understand what do catfishermen want. And they're a different group of anglers. They're very much different in a lot of ways. And you do need to market specifically to the catfish angler. First of all, they want you to. They want catfish stuff. They don't want a bass rod, you know, or a hook that's made for walleye. They want something specifically tested for catfish and something that works.
Okay, you said something I got to ask. You said quiet bottoms making noise. Are you one of the guys that doesn't play the radio and lets the anchor down silently and all of that fun stuff?
Well, you can play your radio all day long. Catfish ain't going to hear it. That's the deal. But if you stomp a little hard on the bottom of that boat, they're going to hear that. Catfish are one of the most unique things that I love studying about catfish is their senses. And they are, I like to say, they're turbocharged. All of their senses almost are turbocharged. And they have one of the most incredible senses of hearing of any animal on earth. They have special bones in their head that are connected to their swim bladder and connect directly to the part of their brain that analyzes sound. And those bones and the swim bladder make them extremely aware of low frequency sounds. Now, if the sound is in the air, they can't hear it. They can only hear the sound that goes through the water. And me and you talking, they don't hear that. But if you bang on your boat or drop something in the bottom, they definitely hear that. I'll give you a good example of that sense. My father-in-law had a little pond behind his house full of channel catfish, and he fed those catfish every couple of days. He was a little guy. He probably didn't weigh 120 pounds soaking wet. But when he walked to his back door and stood on the doorstep, you could watch out at the pond 100 yards away, and those catfish were coming up at the top because they knew he was walking out there to feed them. The only way they could know was hearing the vibrations from his footsteps inside his house. But I guarantee you, I could take you out there any day, and he could walk to the door, and as soon as he got to the door, those catfish were coming up ready to get fed. That's how incredibly sensitive their hearing is. Then if you add in their incredible sense of smell, taste, they're covered head to toe with taste buds. There's so much about them that's just supercharged to me. And if you really want to be a catfish angler and catch a lot of fish, you got to be aware of those things. For example, their sense of taste, they can taste some things at one part per 10 billion parts. For example, that's about equivalent to a drop of water in a railroad tanker. And they can detect that. So let's say you just rub sunscreen all over your face. I can tell you right now, catfish don't like sunscreen. It turns them off and they won't bite. If you rub sunscreen on with your hands and you touch your bait even a little, you ain't going to get a bite probably. And that's why. But you may not realize that because you didn't know that. If you get a drop of gasoline on your hands or The one thing that I had to learn more than anything, I used to be a smoker. They hate tobacco, and they can taste tobacco on your hands. And I had to learn all that. Every time I went fishing, if I wanted to catch a big fish, I needed to realize I got to watch those things and try not to do something that was going to mess me up, because those fish are so supercharged with all these incredible senses.
I never touch anything with my bait hand. I mean, my right hand's for the knife and the sunscreen and all that fun stuff, but my left hand doesn't touch any of that. But I'm still the guy that launches the anchor at full tilt and lets her buck down, and I don't care about sound all that much. But my theory with the anchor is they're down there and trees are falling and other things are smacking, and they're not going to know some guy just dropped an anchor on top of them. They're just not going to know. That's my theory.
I've seen some situations where you can make as much noise as you wanted banging around, wouldn't bother them a bit. And then I've been in other situations where that was the factor that turned them off. So I think you gotta play with things. You gotta know that's a possibility. Is that something I need to be aware of? And it's not all. There's no hard and fast rules. That's the other thing you need to realize. You may hear this is what you ought to do, but it doesn't always pan out that way.
Yeah, I've been playing with different bait combinations the last few years. I mean, we could go on and on about scent all day, but I found totally by accident that I prefer my suckers dead for a day before I cut them, rather than live before I cut them. Certain temperatures, they got to switch over to frozen. I found that and done. Of course, you know me, I have to keep records on all of it, so I got it all proven on paper. But the last couple of years, we use a lot of frogs up here in the late summer. The last couple of years, when the frogs move at night, when the dew is on the grass, those fish will be up eating those frogs on the edge, and at night the frogs work good. But we found when it's hot during the day, the frogs quit moving, and usually it's right around lunchtime, the catfish switch back over to fish for the daytime until the sun sets and the dew comes back out and the whole cycle starts over again with the frogs moving. Not saying you can't catch one on frogs, just saying that it was a very noticeable switch to switch out your bait at a certain time. And there was one time, it was about 2 weeks long, it was literally 11 a.m., at 11:01, you get your frogs off because they're not going to eat it anymore.
baits are. I love learning more about baits. Almost every week, I hear of some new bait somebody's using. See, you guys use frogs a lot. They don't use them here. They never have, and I never really understood that. It's not that catfish don't eat frogs here; they do, but for some reason, that never became a very popular bait here. Now, I had an uncle, though. He used them, and he caught big fish with them. He taught me a trick. Always hook your frog in the back leg. A lot of people want to hook them through the nose or the front leg. He said, hook them back in that back leg and let them swim around better. But that's a bait we never used here, and I'd never heard about it until I was an adult, and I'd been fishing for 25 years. And I started reading Master Angler records in Nebraska to see what they were using. And that was one of the big baits that caught those giant channel cats in Nebraska was frogs. But there's so many baits that we can use that different areas work different ways. And the key to what I think you just said is keep records on things and try to learn from what you're doing. Keeping a journal is a really good idea. I always have. And most of the best anglers I know do, too. They keep a record. What's the weather like? What are the frogs doing today or whatever it might be?
I couldn't tell you how much money is in my checking account right now, but I can tell you who I fished with and what I caught in 2009.
I'm the same way, Brad.
So we're running out of time here, or we could go on all
night.
Wow,
already?
Yeah, we're pushing up on an hour already.
Gee willikers.
So there's one not fishing-related question, and I did ask if I could ask it, but I think it's worth telling because of just, number one, it could have been a terrible story and ended up being a real happy story, but tell us your buffalo story.
Yeah, a little over 3 years ago, a lot of folks here probably won't know, I have a full-time job now working in the public relations department for Arkansas Farm Bureau. And my job is to visit farms and tell those farmers' stories and try to help people know better what farmers do. And one story I was working on a little over 3 years ago was a story on farmers who raised exotic animals. And I had been to, for example, an alpaca farm, and I went to a farm where they raised water buffaloes. And then I went to a farm where the guy was raising bison, American buffaloes. And he had a herd of 50 bison. I spent a good part of the day shooting photos and learning what he did. And toward the end of the day, the gentleman wanted me to get my photo taken with his favorite bison, an old cow, big animal, really huge, that he had all his guests have their picture made with her. And he put the pictures on the wall. Well, I'd had a bad run-in with a bison once upon a time in Nebraska. I had a big bull run me up on my truck while I was doing photos one day. That one, I was fast enough back then, I got away, and I was lucky. He ran over my camera gear, but he didn't get me. So I knew bison could be dangerous, and all day I'd kept on the opposite side of the fence from this guy's bison, but I finally let him talk me into getting my picture made. And so this big old cow came up, and he is feeding her out of his hand. And she was used to him rubbing her head when he'd give her a treat. And she was right standing facing me right in front of me, and she put her head down so he could scratch her head while he's feeding her. And when she lifted her head, this bison was tame as she could be. She was used to people. She wasn't aggressive. But when she lifted her head back up by accident, she hooked my belt loop with one of her horns. And I watched in horror as this happened. And I knew what was going to happen when she felt my weight on her. And I got my finger in that belt loop and tried to break it before she lifted her head up. And I couldn't. And what happened was what I expected. As she lifted her head and felt my weight, she went berserk. I weigh 235 pounds. She threw me up in the air like a little rag doll. And the gentleman just told me recently, I didn't know for sure. I said, "How long was I up there before y'all got me off?" He said, "Probably 2 or 3 minutes she threw you around." A lot of people say, "Did you make it to 8 seconds?" I said, "Yeah, darn near made to 8 minutes. She threw me around on top of her head. I had a hand on one horn, and she was banging me with the other. But when it was all said and done, this guy and his brother, they both had a hold of one of my legs trying to get me off. And finally, literally the metal hook on my belt straightened out and my belt came loose and I fell off. I'll be honest with you, I've had a lot of bad encounters with wildlife as a photographer, alligators, bears, nothing like this that really I felt like I was going to die. I thought I was going to die. And I figured when I got off, I probably was going to die then. And I couldn't catch my breath, and they tried to do CPR on me. And I finally got to where I could say, "Please don't do CPR on me anymore. I'm going to be okay." And I caught my breath, and I said, "I guess you guys need to look at me and see how bad this bison hurt me." So I pulled my shirt up. She'd had one horn on each side from behind me. And I was pretty sure she hadn't gored me. I didn't think she had, but boy, I was in bad shape. And they looked at me, though, and said, "Nothing. There's no blood. There's no nothing." I sat there about an hour and got my breath back and felt okay, and I could stand. There's no blood or anything. I actually decided, okay, I'm all right. And I called my wife and said, "I'm going to come home, but this is what happened." And on my way home, I called work, and they wanted me to go get checked out. So I had about a 100-mile drive, and I felt fine the first 95 miles. And then as I got close to where my wife works here in Little Rock, I started feeling dizzy. And I called her. I said, I think I better come by and let you take me to the hospital. I'm starting to feel dizzy. By the time I got to her office, just a short drive away from that point, I don't remember anything much more that day. I woke up, I don't know, a couple of hours later, and there were about 10 doctors standing around me in the hospital. And I said, gosh, I never seen this many doctors. Am I dying? And he said, no, it just none of us ever saw a guy that rode a buffalo and got hurt before. Everybody came to see the buffalo guy. And I said, well, am I going to live? And he said, oh, yeah, you're going to live. In fact, you're going to want to go kiss this buffalo because she saved your life. I said, well, I don't really feel that way. How did she do that? He said, did you know you had cancer on one of your kidneys? And I said, no. He said, well, you do. And you never would have known had you not come in here and gotten a CT scan because of this buffalo. So literally, we're going to have to take your kidney out, but you'll live and be fine. Whereas if you hadn't come in here, you probably would have died from this cancer and never knew you had it. And so it took me about 4 months to recover from the buffalo ride, laid up in bed. I was in pretty bad shape for a while. And then they took my kidney out, and no cancer. I just had my three-year checkup. I don't have to go back anymore. I'm clear. And all thanks to this buffalo. If I hadn't have ridden her, I would have never known. It was a scary thing. It makes me think a little bit more seriously about being around big animals. The next week, I had a friend that got hurt even worse by a cow that had just had a calf that caught him from behind. So, you know, it can happen. You get complacent sometimes. And really, I wasn't complacent that day. It was just an accident that this animal hooked my belt loop. But it's an unforgettable story for sure.
It's such a crazy story, and then it has a good outcome because you would have never known.
Yeah.
You know, you had posted that on Facebook, the abbreviated version of that story. I was sitting, I can tell you exactly where I was sitting. I was sitting in Fort Francis, Ontario, waiting for the fog to clear to go on a fly-in trip for lake trout. And I'm reading it to myself going, oh my God, guys, listen to this. I was reading it out loud in this air service going, holy cow.
Well, it's a good story to add to my repertoire of good stories. I'm kind of one of those guys. I always push the limit a little too much. I'm getting too old to do that now. I'm fixing to turn 65. But, you know, all those trips to Brazil and all around the country and different things and being a wildlife photographer, everybody that knows me closely will tell you I've pushed the limit too much a lot of times, and I've been really lucky. I mean, I've always felt like, you know what, live life to the fullest. My mom and her dad both died when they were 40 years old. And I always figured I was next in that line, you know. And I better get everything done before I'm 40, or there may not be any more time. So I lived hard, and I always played hard, too. So it makes a good story. But, boy, I don't ever want to go through it again, I'll tell you that. It was a scary thing. It's the most frightening thing that ever happened to me out of a lot of frightening.
Well, it's a heck of a story. So I got one more question. When are you coming up to fish with me?
I tell you what, Brad, you are number one, literally, on my list of people I want to fish with. And I mean that sincerely. I have always wanted to go back to the Red River since that one trip I made. I actually made that trip. I was working on that first catfish book. And we spent 9 days on the Red River shooting photos for that book because the publisher actually asked me when he agreed to do the book, where would you like to go shoot photos? And that was my first answer. I'd like to go to the Red River, and then I'd also like you to send your photographers down here, and we do photos on the Mississippi River down here. two different scenarios entirely. It provided us a very wide array of photography for the book that turned out wonderful. So I want to come back and fish the red. And since I know you and I have seen all the monstrous fish you catch up there, and I'd like to come and sit in the boat with you and learn some new stuff. And I hope it's soon. I'm going to retire before too long. And that ought to give me some time to do just that.
Well, you know my number, so I want to thank you for coming on, spending an hour with me. I'm sure everybody's going to really enjoy it. For those of you who are catching us in the middle, Keith Catfish Sutton, books are all on Amazon. You still have your website running to buy them as well?
I actually don't. I have taken down my website just because of cost. It got way too expensive for me to keep it up. So you can find all my books on Amazon.
Amazon it is. Keith, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, this was fun, Brad, and maybe someday we can do it again, but especially I hope to get up there and fish with you sometime. And I appreciate the invitation.
Wonderful. And you have a great 2021.
Same to you, Brad, and happy holidays.
That does it for this episode of Catfish Best Source. Between now and then, be sure to check out Grand Forks Best Source for local podcasts, news, and interviews. Also, you can look me up at redrivercatfish.com. Find me on Facebook and Instagram. Until next week, I'm your host, Brad Durick.